This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Jacqueline Woodson is the author of more than two dozen books, including Brown Girl Dreaming, which won the National Book Award in 2014, and her latest novel, Red at the Bone. Well, last year, Woodson traveled to Ghana to participate in that country's Year of Return initiative. It encourages members of the African diaspora, including African Americans, to come to Ghana for a year and try to reconnect roots that were severed during the Atlantic slave trade. Jacqueline is here with me now to talk about the experience, the first time she ever set foot on the African continent. Jacqueline, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
What is Ghana's Year of Return initiative?
Well, it's, as you said, it's an invitation back to the motherland, back, quote unquote, home for people of the African diaspora, a chance to reconnect with African ancestors, reconnect with the land, reconnect with the African heritage, the various African heritages, and get a sense of the place that we left many, many generations ago.
And how did you wind up taking part? How did you get involved?
I got involved because I was asked to write a piece for the New York Times about it. And I hadn't thought that that would be the way I would finally get to Africa. My family and I had talked about going at some point to South Africa. At one point, we were going to travel to Rwanda, and that fell through. But when this opportunity came along, it felt like it was the right time to go home.
So the right time to go home, but as I understand it, you were also somewhat hesitant to go along, weren't you?
Yes, yes, I was very hesitant at the same time. And mainly, I kind of was side-eyeing the invitation. Was it an invitation based on the American dollar and sinking that into African soil? We had, you know, some of us had exist in this country in a very economically sound way. And I think the invitation, it's expensive to travel to Africa. It's expensive to rent a hotel. It's expensive to get on the plane. It's expensive to take that kind of time off. And the invitation to come there and be a part of it was not to do so for free. So I kind of side-eyed the idea of, do they want my African diasporic self, or do they want my American dollars? Mm.
Are they trading off the fact that I'm pretty motivated to go and have an authentic experience in Africa, and I'm probably willing to pay for it? Is that just another marketplace?
Mm-hmm, exactly. Well, so I did question that.
And ultimately, what tipped the scales for you that you said, okay, worth the money certainly, but the experience trumps the commercial demands here?
I think a number of things tipped the scales. One was my children. I felt like it was important for them to see Africa. And we had traveled extensively, you know, in Europe, and it made no sense that Black children hadn't experienced African soil. I also, given the climate in America for people of color, you know, it's horrible right now. And so I thought, if we needed to go someplace else, if we needed to live someplace else, where would that place be? Where could our family feel safe?
Even a spirit of maybe scouting out someplace else to go, that's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was your first time ever going to Africa, as I mentioned. So take me back to that moment, or maybe that first hour. What was it like for you stepping off that plane for the first time?
It was interesting. I mean, first, in terms of the plane ride itself, when we transferred, we had to get a flight into Ghana, and we went from a really large well taken care of plane to one that was really small, and it just felt ignored in a way that made me nervous stepping onto that plane and flying, and then going from a flight that I think we changed in London, but going from a flight that was predominantly white to getting onto a plane that was predominantly Black was amazing, and then stepping off that plane into And getting into the airport and seeing so many black and brown faces, I think it kind of was deeply surprising for my young for my two kids, but really surprising for my partner and I too. And it felt deeply familiar in a way that it's hard to explain in terms of stepping into a country that you've never been in this case, you know, Ghana, and feeling like you had been there before.
I'm interested in the first 6 hours of your experience. You know, you're feeling a sense of familiarity. There's black and brown faces everywhere. And yet you're an American. You're a foreigner. Mm-hmm. You grew up in a very different place. I know that for sure. Many of the things you see and hear and smell are very different from home. I know that too. Take me inside those first 6 hours for you. What was going on in your head?
Jet lag. So once we pushed
past
the jet lag, it was the sound of Ghana, you know, of Accra, the city streets that were so filled with sound. And I think one of the first images that really stays with me was watching African women walk through the streets with bundles on their heads. And this had almost been this kind of cliche image growing up, right? The minute you see some cartoon of an African woman, she has something on her head, and to the point where it was almost defensive when you saw it as a cartoon. And then to get into the real world of this and see the beauty and the brilliance of their straight backs and the balance, and to see these huge bundles on their head as they walk through the streets selling everything from plantain chips to plastic bags of water, and to see, you know, little black kids running through the streets as well. All of that it felt lovely in this way, and also very surprising. I think the noise of Accra was really interesting to me in that it reminded me, of course, a lot of when my family spent time in Mumbai. It was the same kind of crazy traffic in the streets. But here, every person we saw was my complexion, just about, and every sign we saw, every billboard was of black people. And this was something, of course, we had never experienced in the U.S., except for white Jesus, which was also really surprising to me.
Oh, so all these black and brown faces in the streets, on the mopeds, everywhere.
On the billboards, yes.
And still white Jesus.
White Jesus, because, you know, the missionaries did their work.
They did. God, that makes me laugh. Oh, God, that there's almost a whole show there. So there were.
But what's interesting, even about white Jesus, when we get sober about it, I talk to people about it, about how they could, you know, see white Jesus and all of this black and brownness, and believe that to be Jesus. And what people said was really interesting. It's like, that's just the body. That's not who we see as our savior. Like, you know, it's almost like looking at a cross, right? This is just this something that represents what we believe in, but is not necessarily, we don't think that a white man is going to save us. So I thought that was really interesting to really kind of investigate that, because I was like, wait a second. What is up with this? So it was something that was eye-opening for me in the way that I went into the country thinking about certain things one way and left thinking about them another way.
That's fascinating. Well, there's a whole bunch of activities offered during this year of return trip that you are on. There's a natural hair expo, first bath of return, a naming ceremony. Were you at any point skeptical about some of these add-ons and maybe what the point of some of these things were? I mean, you mentioned already that they weren't free, and I wonder if some of them gave you either kind of a hokey feeling or a feeling that maybe somebody was taking advantage of what clearly was a very deep experience for you and for your children.
You know, I didn't participate in a lot of that. And I was very intentional about that. I really wanted to go to Ghana and see if it was a place I could feel that I belonged to. And I think in terms of the naming ceremony, I know people who participated in that and were completely moved by it. I know about the African naming ceremony, and I do believe in that. I do believe that that idea of having a baby, bringing it into the world, and waiting to see who they are before naming them. And in the same way that to go back to Africa, to go back to the motherland, right, and get a name there is a very moving thing. But I didn't want to participate in it because I really went there with a certain intention. And it really was not to mock what they were doing or to say that that's not right. Again, going back to capitalism, I did question that. Like, you know, are they trying to get my American dollars or is there some truth in this? So natural hair ceremony, I thought that was interesting because two Black women don't get in a room and not talk about hair. I mean, that's what we, you know, hair is a very huge part of our culture and conversation. I mean, we have this amazing hair, you know, we have this hair that can do so many things. So, of course, you know, we make choices about what's going to happen with our hair at the workplace, what's going to happen with our hair in the public space, who can touch our hair, who can't touch our hair. And so that it made sense to me. But it wasn't what I wanted to be a part of with my family on my journey back to Africa.
You know, Jacqueline, I read your accounts. They reminded me, you know, there are similar programs in Israel designed to give American Jews a connection to the country while visiting for the first time. And mm-hmm. a lot of people see these trips as eye-opening. Some see mm-hmm. them as inauthentic propaganda to build support for the state of Israel. I wonder mm-hmm. if you sensed, the politics are very, very different, but I wonder if you sensed any of the, a similar or at least analogous conflict.
Well, you know, Birthright is a much older program and and Israel is a much richer place.
Yeah.
I mean, Africa has the rich soil, but the land has been raped for so many generations. Of course, there is a similarity in, you know, establishing a birthright program for people who might not have a connection to Africa because so many generations of their family have been in the U.S., or not in the U.S., outside of Africa. So I think that there is this sense that it makes sense. It makes sense to do this program. And there's this idea that people are going to approach it in very different ways, right? I talk to people who would not even think about doing something like this. And I've talked to people who went and did it and were changed. But it's interesting because as someone of the African diaspora, I do think now that every Black child should go to Africa at some point. And I didn't think that before I went.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
You think it's an experience that every Black child would benefit from, which argues, if that's true, for a vastly expanded return initiative, birthright-like program for millions mm-hmm. of Black kids.
Mm-hmm. And I think the U.S. should pay for it. would be amazing.
The United States government.
Yeah, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? You know, part of reparations, just pay for that birthright trip.
You know, birthright trips to Israel are free, not paid by the government, of course, although maybe some people suspect that. They're paid by private foundations who think that it's important for young American Jews to go have that connection.
Yeah, well, I wish we had that kind of money, but we know what happened to Black money in this country. So, you know, if there are those private foundations out there that could help make this happen, I wouldn't mind that at all. Mm. So it'd be interesting to see how it happens.
A fascinating argument, though, that to make that there is a renewed reparations debate in this country. People mm-hmm. talk primarily about money, although it's about so much more, about building wealth, about wealth stolen, generational wealth stolen. But here's mm-hmm. an idea that has much more cultural currency, right? Having mm-hmm. all of us contribute to the return, at least momentarily or spiritually of American black kids to where their people came from.
Mm-hmm. It would be amazing.
I just think it's a fascinating concept. I had not heard that argument before. I want to play you just a little bit of an interview from the CBC in Canada, Ghanaian-American writer Yah Jesse, who spoke about her trip to Ghana and the transformative experience of touring the Cape Coast slave castle, which would become the basis for her novel, Homegoing. Listen.
So in 2009, I got a grant from Stanford University, where I was studying, to travel to Ghana and conduct research for this novel. And it was while there that I took a tour of the Cape Coast Castle, which is a slave castle in Cape Coast in the central region of Ghana. And I had never been there before, had never really heard about it before. And it was on this tour that the tour guide started to talk to us about how the British soldiers who lived and worked in this castle would sometimes marry the local women. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And I was so struck by that, the idea that there could be women up above walking free, kind of unaware of what was going on below them.
Author Yah Jesse talking about her experience visiting the Cape Coast Castle on the Cape Coast in Ghana and the basis of her novel, Homegoing. I'm speaking with Jacqueline Woodson. Jacqueline, hold the line for just a moment. We're going to take a pause, and then I want to talk about some of your experiences seeing similar things, seeing a slave castle during your trip to Ghana with your family as part of the return initiative that you went on. Ghana's Year of Return is an initiative to encourage the descendants of slaves to visit the country where thousands of Africans were sold into the Atlantic slave trade. Writer Jacqueline Woodson participated in what's called the Year of Return. She wrote about the mix of emotions that she experienced during her trip. Much more from Jacqueline Woodson and her travel memories. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from our sponsor, Target. Entrepreneur Ray Phillips reflects on the mentorship and support he's received from Target throughout his journey.
Really, to have a company like Target extend a helping hand and guide us along in the process, it makes all the difference for any striving company looking to play on a higher level.
Learn more about how Target supports diverse entrepreneurs at target.com/founderswelove.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know. On the News Roundup, find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
On a secret military recording, a sound so haunting, one scientist believed it could change the world.
My mind was racing as I listened to this, and I thought, this is the way.
Join NPR's Invisibilia for the first episode of our new season.
I'm speaking with writer Jacqueline Woodson about her trip to Ghana for the country's Year of Return initiative and what returning to Africa means as an African-American straddling the line of multiple identities. Jacqueline, I mentioned fellow writer Yah Jesse. We also played some of her sound from the CBC in Canada in an interview describing a visit to a slave castle on one of her trips. And you and your family went to a slave castle during your journey there. What was that experience like for you, walking where enslaved Africans were kept for weeks, if not months?
You know, I think if I had been in the castle alone, or in the forts alone, it would have been a different experience. And I had heard from so many people about the experience that I feel like I had my guards up around it. But I think if I had been alone, I would have probably broke down and cried, because what is true is the energy is still there. The smells are still there. You know, the sounds of the slamming gates are still there. You walk out into the courtyard, and the guide is telling you how the women were chosen to be raped and then given a bath so that they could be presented to the rapist again and again. And you think about the hundreds of bodies piled into these very, very tiny spaces and how fetid those spaces became, and the deep disregard of the history of the black and brown body. And I think that all of that definitely comes rushing back to you. And I write about this in the Times article. You see the water, and the water is so beautiful in this way, and also so heartbreaking because it was the point of no return. People stepped out onto those ships and never saw home again. But you could really feel that deep despair in those spaces. And for me, it's also this idea that as enslaved people, we were not meant to survive, right? So many of us died in those forts. So many of us died on those ships. So many of us died once we got to, you know, the U.S., the Caribbean, to Europe, wherever the trading took us. And so many of us died during the hundreds of years of being enslaved. And that, and the fact that we survived is amazing. And it's what I tell my kids every single day. But also standing there with my family and thinking again, wow, we survived this. And therefore, we are amazing. So it was definitely a lot of feelings going on. I didn't break down, but every sense is involved. You know, you hear it, you smell it, you see it, you feel it. You know, you taste it. The minute you open your mouth, you feel the hunger of the people. It's a lot. And I would do it again. I'm so glad I went to that fort. I'm so glad I saw the water. I saw the passageway. And I'm so glad for how evocative it was.
You know, I've had similar experiences in different places. The only thing I can tell you is that some of them left a scar and feelings that have never gone away. And I've been in places like that for myself that I thought I would never want to go back. It actually really heartens me to know that it was a better experience for you and one that's wound up being one of connection and positivity with your children.
Well, you know, there's a saying about people of the African diaspora and Africans in general is we carry with us our wounds and our medicine, right? And so that idea that you can go to these very hurt places and they can be healing, or you know how to heal from them, because it's about survival. So, and I think that's why I write for adolescents too, right?
Because of course,
I can go back to those heartbreaking places and create something positive out of it.
Of course. That makes much more sense. I think about myself as an adult and how hard that was for many years visiting similar places that just, as I said, left a scar. And for adolescents, it can be so much different, especially when they're guided by an adult and by a writer, but by an adult who can hold their hand. Well, I'm interested in how you grew up thinking about Africa and how it was different from the Africa that you saw once you found yourself in Ghana. Was there a clash there?
You know, I grew up with a very theoretical Africa. My family came from the South, right? So we come from a history on my mom's side of enslavement, and we come from a history on my dad's side of free blacks. And it's just interesting that in that narrative, there was not Africa. So the Africa that I knew, you know, I was one of those people who probably as a kid thought Africa was a country, right? Until I learned that it's a continent and it's huge and it has many, many countries. But I didn't have a lot of information about Africa until I started studying it. And then even then, like my connection to it was so far removed that even saying African American didn't feel like it was a connection to Africa. It felt like it was a connection to being African American, which is complicated and hard to explain. But it wasn't until I was, and then every, you know, and again, I talk about this, like the cartoons, the racism in the cartoons, the supposedly African quote unquote savages and the bones in their noses and all of these really destructive stereotypes of what got represented on television about Africa pushed me further away from it, right? And it wasn't until I really started understanding my own genetic history that I began to understand the greatness of that continent and the history there.
Well, something that you were concerned about ahead of the trip, you've written, was how your family, your white partner, Juliet, mm-hmm. and your two biracial kids would be received and looked upon by people looking at you in Ghana. How was your family received?
I was often called sister. I think of the family, I probably moved through Ghana the easiest. And I was traveling with my friend Catherine McKinley, who goes back and forth to Ghana a lot and who's biracial and very Ghanaian identified. I think my kids, it's so interesting because they're African people in Ghana, because this is where I experienced it, were so friendly and so kind to the children, right? Even the other children, like the minute they saw our kids, it's like, running to play with them. And there's just this kind of openness of embracing family. I think for my partner, we constantly got asked if we were sisters. I mean, if you saw my partner, it's ridiculous. But but maybe they didn't mean biologically sisters. So it was a lovely, lovely reception. Of course, in places like the markets where people were trying to sell us lots and lots of stuff, I think my kids got seriously overwhelmed because not only were items being pushed at them, but they were being pushed at them in this very friendly way, right? So, and they're very polite kids, and they're not going to say, get that out of my face, or I'm not interested. They'll engage in a conversation while walking backwards away. But it was when we talked about it afterwards, like they were ready to go back. They're ready to see another part of Africa. They're ready to travel back to Ghana. So that makes me think it was a real positive experience for them.
We have to take a short break, but we'll be back with more from author Jacqueline Woodson in just a moment. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hi, I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and I am the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. I am so excited because we are working on a bunch of new, amazing episodes. We're exploring big ideas about reinvention, making amends, and the psychological effects of climate change. Our first show drops March 13th. Please join me.
This is 1A. Returning now to our conversation with Jacqueline Woodson and her year of return experiences. Jacqueline, you write about how you experienced a kind of double consciousness while there, mm-hmm. belonging at the same time not belonging. And I think you started to allude to this a little bit a minute or two ago. What does that feel like to you? Is that a feeling that you feel can be reconciled?
Yes, I think it is. I think it is a feeling I have here in this country, right? I am of this place, I'm from this place, but I really, I'm in this place, but am I of this place? I don't know. I'm very American in so many ways and in so many ways not. The same with New York. I grew up in the South until I was 7. And so those imprinting years, I'm very Southern. So I feel kind of outside in New York all the time. And so getting to Ghana and seeing everyone who is my complexion or darker or slightly lighter, walking like I do, our language, the way we speak is different, but the openness is the same, feeling very Southern to me. And then it not being my place, right? It's kind of, for me in the end, it did feel like, yes, this is who... This is how I will always walk through the world.
conflicted.
And with feet in
more than one place. Talk a little bit more about that 2 feet in two places or feet in multiple places feeling, because it's fascinating.
You know, it's at once kind of it's a gift, right? And when you look at it positively, if I didn't have feet in so many worlds, I wouldn't have been able to write 32 books. I mean, you know, it's what builds empathy, is how we begin to understand. And at the same time, I do wonder what it would be like to exist solely in one place, in one body, as one being. And that's never been the case for me. So going to Africa, I didn't feel like I was going to be completely outside of it simply by the color of my skin. I knew that some part of me was going to have a belonging there, but I didn't know that I would at the same time feel this outsiderness and where that outsiderness would play out. It played out, you know, of course, in economics. It played out in language. I move differently than a lot of African women, even though my daughter moves like the African women. So that was all very interesting to me.
Well, you've said that there isn't enough space in the New York Times travel section to capture the enormity of this experience. I hope we've gotten closer in this time we've spent together on the air. But if you could go down a road that you haven't explored yet in writing about your trip to Ghana or your children's experience or your experience with your partner, I don't know, what do you think that would be?
I think I would want to go down the road of my children who identify as Black and biracial, right? You know, they always say we're Black and we're biracial, to make sure both of those parts of themselves are acknowledged. And what does it mean to be Black and biracial in Ghana? What does it mean to be completely immersed in an African culture for, say, 5 years, 10 years, what would that look like for them? I think there's so many roads. And I also think I want to hear other voices. There's so much room to write about this, to write about our experiences as African Americans, as Caribbean Americans, and as Africans. So I have the roads that I would like to explore, but I also am always so interested in the voices of other writers telling these stories.
And we've talked on this show before about how American journalistic views of Africa can be so very narrow. You mentioned it before, the idea that Africa is one thing. Mm-hmm. Of course it isn't. This sounds like an opportunity to broaden that perspective, make it even more granular than before, to get more voices talking about their personal experiences visiting Africa.
Exactly.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about what you really wanted to get out of this trip was some truth. I suppose that's what writers are always looking for, whether they're fiction or nonfiction writers. At least I hope so. I think the truth ultimately is what you're looking for. Do you think you got it?
I think I got some of the truths. I think there are many of them. And I think each time I go back, I'll get some more. But for me, I feel like the truth that I got was that I am of that place too. And that matters, that I can go there and even with the sense of unbelonging I felt, to also feel that sense of belonging. And next time to go and further explore what that truth means and how that truth manifests with more time there, with knowing more people, with doing more stuff. So, yeah, you're right. It is, you know, I think as writers, we're constantly searching for the truths that matter to us and by extension matter to a greater good and a bigger world. And I'm at the beginning of it.
And I think sometimes that sense of belonging, that you get a little bit of a sense of your first time you go to a place, that can give way to a sense of longing to go back and be part of it. And maybe that's in your future too. Jacqueline Woodson, author of Brown Girl Dreaming and Red at the Bone. Jacqueline, what a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was nice talking to you.
You too. This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the website at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.